debt collection actions leading up to that Aegis foreclosure, which took place in January of 2014. Specifically, the action that took place in the one-year period prior to the complaint that was filed, the FDCPA complaint. The third issue is the applicability of the continuing violation doctrine in the discovery rule to the debt collector's actions outside of the one-year period before the filing of the complaint. This relationship, if you will, between the debt collectors and Ms. McNair spanned more than 4 years. So and all of these actions were interrelated. The first issue I'll get into is the foreclosure and the applicability of the FDCPA. And we'll start the discussion with the case of Ho v. Recon Trust, an opinion I know that Judge Kaczynski authored. It was recently amended after we did our briefing on it, and I just realized that on Tuesday night when we filed a quick notice of the amended superseded opinion. My review of it is the holding is the same. There was some rationale that was modified, but for purposes here, I think either one counts. Obviously, I'll refer to the amended and superseded opinion. As stated in the amended, the current Ho opinion, the TF Trust has three actors. There's the lender, the borrower, and the trustee. And in that case, the trustee was the FDCPA defendant. The trustee's role in that case, Ho, was very limited. It did a notice of trustee sale, and it did not notice of sale. And that's all that it did. Here in this case at bar, there were four actors. There was the Homeowners Association, which is like the lender. There was the owner, Mr. Mayor, who was like the borrower. There was the sheriff, who actually conducted the sale. Did he notice of sale, just like a notice of trustee sale, conducted the sale, collected the proceeds, distributed it, gave the sheriff's to, just like a trustee gets a trustee's to
the sale. You're talking about all of these people being involved in the rent proceedings? Sorry, when are you saying all these actors were involved?
But these actors were involved in the foreclosure proceedings. Other than the sheriff, the three actors were also involved in the debt collection proceedings leading up to the writ and the foreclosure. The fourth actor that you don't have in the whole case, there's the appellees here, the National Oregon Law Firm and its lawyers. So their role here was not as the trustee. They're not the trustee here. The sheriff was the trustee. Maxwell Morgan was a representative of the Homeowners Association, and it was this provider of information to the sheriff. And so, with that in mind, I think you need to look at the whole thing in O, which was very narrow. It basically just says that a trustee in a deed of trust sale is not a debt collector for purposes of the FDCPA. But the opinion in O, this paragraph was in the old opinion in the new. That's at page 573 of the new opinion. First full paragraph. We do not hold that the FDCPA intended to exclude all entities whose principal purpose is to enforce security interests. And entities that enforce security interests engage in activities that constitute debt collections. They are debt collectors. We hold only that the enforcement of a security interest is not always debt collection. So Maxwell Morgan here, they did much more than simply foreclosed. They didn't actually do the foreclosure. The sheriff did that. They provided information, misinformation, to the sheriff. The writ, which was the communication to the sheriff, was it grossly overstated the amount owed. It completely failed to acknowledge and account for all the payments that Ms. McNair made, increasing the amount owed on the document that the sheriff relied upon.
Was the writ, though, trying to collect those amounts, or was it trying to foreclose on the house? Was it trying to enforce the security interest?
The writ is a tool to collect the amounts owed to the association.
It's a tool to foreclose on the house?
It's a tool to direct the sheriff to sell the house to some third party, and to then take those proceeds and pay the association. In a deed of trust situation, you have a lender, maybe have this large antecedent debt generally, maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars that they're suing, here with assessments, you have very much smaller amounts that are secured by a house that's maybe worth a couple $100,000. So it's just a tool to collect that amount owed. And again, it's not something you have to see the debt. You're just obligated to pay assessments moving forward.
Why does it matter what the amount of the debt is? Isn't it just enforcing a security interest, though, in order to get whatever debt it is that you have?
It is enforcing a security interest in order to collect the debt. But Maxwell Morgan's and the appellees here, their role was not exclusively limited to just enforcing the security interest. And I think what
maybe we need to separate out the different parts of what you're challenging, but I have trouble understanding how you can challenge any of the writ because it seems like it falls under Ho. I haven't yet heard you say something that distinguishes it really from Ho.
Okay. I think with the writ, again, it is a tool that they're using in communication, that they're providing this information, and this information is wrong. It's overstating amounts. And that is just part of their job in trying to collect the debt. They have been working this amount for 4 years.
Would we be conflicting with the state court if we agreed with you that the amounts were wrong? Would we be relitigating an issue that's been decided by the state court?
No, Your Honor, because what we're seeing is that they made misrepresentations, and we're challenging.
But did the state court find that the amounts were appropriate?
Well, the writ itself is something that Mentor and Morgan lodges and just issues sentences to the court for issuance for signature by the clerk. It doesn't actually even go in front of the judge. It's just issued by the clerk and then served upon the sheriff, who then does whatever the writ says.
Did you ever challenge in state court the amounts of fees or have other things owed? You had.
Yes, Your Honor, that there were challenges. We did try to stop the sheriff's sale. I believe the timing of it was the writ already issued. The sheriff had even noticed
that. The court rejected your arguments, correct?
Yes, the court
said. So how can we say the amounts were incorrect, given that the state court has already ruled on that issue? Don't you have an issue preclusion problem?
I don't think we do, because what we've got here is we're saying that their misrepresentations and unfair practices are what's at issue. We're not saying that the association was right or wrong. We're saying that the appellees as debt collectors for the association made these misrepresentations.
And in the writ documents?
In the writ and in
I know you have several misrepresentations you're alleging, but in the writ documents, I think you challenged those statements in state court, and the state court thought they were okay, and so I don't know how we can assume they're not okay for purposes of your argument here.
Well, I mean, this is a conclusion issue, and I don't think that was an issue that the defendants raised here. I mean, but yes, there was some challenge to the writ or to this foreclosure sale.
Was that challenge directed to the attorney's fees that were included in the writ provided to the sheriff to be sold, which was signed off on by initially the clerk of the court? So the question is, when you say you tried to stop the sheriff's sale, but the court declined your efforts, was there an assessment of the reasonableness of those attorney's fees that were assertive
charged us to. But
the reason you are so that you can get the deficiency of the judicial foreclosure and you can't get the deficiency of the non-judicial foreclosure.
And that is part of the answer, and that was also what we've got there. It's in the brief also, is that that issue is that there is no anti-deficiency protection for these homeowners association fees. And in fact, in their superior court complaint, there are two causes of action, one for judicial foreclosure, but a second for breach of contract for monetary judgment. In the event they want to be able to collect all the monies owed.
You've got about 3 minutes left. Can I save it?
Yes, Your Honor, I would like to save it. That's all time left. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. R. Travis Campbell on behalf of the appellees, and may it please the Court. Your Honors, there are only two timely claims here. The first is based on the attorney's fees that were included in the writ of execution, and the second is based on the alleged failure to promptly respond to the appellant's request for a balance statement. I'd like to talk about the first timely claim first. Who controls the writ of execution, Your Honors? Poe made clear that the relevant inquiry is the act complained of debt collection. In Poe, the court stated that debt collection is seeking money from the person, but the foreclosure process is a completely different entity. That process is to sell property, the proceeds of which come from the seller, are used to then satisfy the obligation. So Poe made clear that if you look at the action, not the actor in the process. And I would just note that Poe directly affirmed the District Court of Oregon's decision in Hulse v. Ocwen. In Hulse v. Ocwen, the court said it's only one element of an FDCPA claim to be a debt collector generally. You have to also engage in debt collection. In that decision, the court said the debt collector was entitled to summary judgment on allegations arising out of its conduct seeking foreclosure, as distinguished from acts engaged in before the initiation of the foreclosure process. And Ho directly adopted that decision. So the relevant inquiry here is, was the writ of execution seeking to collect money from the appellant, or was it seeking to foreclose on property? And it's undisputed that the writ of execution only sought to foreclose, and therefore, it was not subject to the FDCPA. And I would just note that this court's decision recently in Mashiri supports that conclusion, the conclusion of focusing on the conduct, not the role of the actor. In Mashiri v. Epstein, the conduct at issue was a letter. In that letter sought money from the debtor. It also threatened a lien foreclosure action if the debtor failed to pay. The Mashiri court held that was collection because it sought the communication at issue, the conduct at issue, sought money directly from the debtor. Here,
in fact, there's an efficiency possible in the judicial foreclosure. It's not a relevant distinction.
I don't think it is a relevant distinction because
we talked about the non-recourse aspect of it in Hull, right?
That's true, Your Honor.
It was mentioned as a factor, right?
That is true.
The fact that it's not present when you have a judicial foreclosure. Why doesn't that look a lot more like debt collection? You're going to try to collect debt. And whatever you don't collect is by foreclosing, you are then going to go back and try to get directly from the debtor.
I understand, Your Honor. I think here it's not a distinction with a difference because in the judicial foreclosure.
I think we sort of wasted that breath there by mentioning it.
No, Your Honor. I think because we're in the context of a lien involving homeowners' assessments, the amounts are so small that the sale of the property in any practical situation would never fail to satisfy the obligation. So it would seem that it wouldn't be necessary for the Arizona legislature to create an anti-deficiency statute in that scenario because here we're talking about a few thousand dollars owed in homeowners assessment.
That's not the point. The point is there are different kinds of procedures. One of them is a private procedure. It doesn't involve judicial supervision, and you use it in lieu of collecting against them. This is an alternative way of getting your money. Going against the debtor, or you're going against the property.
focus on, you know, the timely claim is only the writ of execution. It's not the judicial foreclosure complaint. It's not any other activity that went on in the attempts to collect. The only timely claim is based on the writ, and the writ undoubtedly only seeks to foreclose on property. And therefore, it does not seek any device. Essentially, what's happened here is the association, through their attorneys, has abandoned attempts to collect from the debtor and has instead exercised its right to foreclose on the property in order to satisfy the proceeds, in order to satisfy the obligation out of the proceeds of the sale.
So if it goes ahead and sells the property and finds out that it doesn't fit just questions as, you know, property values have gone down, and recover the amount is bad enough to cover the secured debt, then the association wouldn't go for the rest of it against the.
Well, I don't know if I can speculate about that. I think that here,
in fact, we could.
Well,
but whether it's supposed to do it or not, they could. But whereas if you go a private sale, that's it. If you don't get any cash out of the private sale, it's too darn bad. So you can't go to the debt.
Well, I think that is certainly a possibility. I think in the context of a homeowners association assessments, that is a completely improbable scenario given the value of property and the amount of the assessments.
It's the question of how much property values are worth compared to the claims, right?
Well, in this particular situation,
we have had situations in the recent past where the actual property value was below the security interest rate.
Well, I'm not aware of any examples where the failure to pay homeowner assessments amounted to more than a property value. But I'm not aware of any examples where the failure to pay homeowner assessments, which are a few hundred dollars a quarter, ended up being a greater liability than the actual value of the property.
It's not the actual value of the property. It's the actual value of the property minus whatever deed of trust, whatever first or second deed of trust might be on, right? The source needs to get paid off first. When you have a sale, you can't recover ahead of the security interest. Those things get paid off first.
All right, and in this situation with homeowner assessments, there is a first lien, there is a super lien on the in connection with the sale, so the assessments are going to get paid off first. But I think the court's point in O was that you focus on the actions. And the action of foreclosure is not seeking money from the person. It's seeking the sale of property. And I think the writ of execution here in Ho, it dealt with two notices that were mailed directly to the debtor that were essentially saying, pay up or we're going to foreclose. Here we're talking about the actual device that accomplished the foreclosure.
I thought I heard you say earlier that the writ, that putting aside the things before the statute of limitations period, the writ itself, which is the timely claim, that by pursuing the writ, they were abandoning other claims of debt from this homeowner. Somehow they didn't get enough money. Did you say that, and is that true?
I think it is true that they have decided when they file the writ that they're only going to seek foreclosure because that's the device they're going to use in order to satisfy the obligation.
But once they do that, say somehow no one wants to buy this thing and they only get $10, can they still collect the rest of the assessment somehow else?
I believe they could under Arizona law, yes.
So the writ, there's nothing about filing a writ that gets rid of other debt, that forecloses the later effort?
I'm not aware of any anti-deficiency statute concerning the lien, no. But in this particular situation, the writ, your requisition is soft foreclosure, and then the obligation was satisfied on the proceeds of the sale. But Your Honors, the claims in the writ of execution failed for a second reason. The only timely claim related to the writ of execution is that the accurate inclusion of post-judgment attorney's fees in the writ would somehow mislead the least sophisticated debtor in the appellant situation. Now, that is the standard the court applies, the least sophisticated debtor, given knowledge of the account history, given knowledge of the prior communications that had gone on between the parties. Here, the prior communication was a stipulation that the appellant signed to settle for debt for less than the amount owed. In that stipulation, it specifically stated that attorney's fees would continue to accrue if she did not make the necessary payments. She failed to do that, and then when the writ was filed, the post-judgment fees, the accruing attorney's fees, were included in the writ. Now, the question is, would the least sophisticated debtor be materially misled by the inclusion of those fees? In other words, would the least sophisticated debtor be unable to intelligently choose her response to the writ based on that alleged misrepresentation? The answer is no. The responses to the writ were simple. There were three of them.
What component of the amount listed in the writ as debt was attorney's fees? What's the difference here that might affect this hypothetical debtor?
I think the amount of post-judgment attorney's fees was a little over $1,500, and the overall writ amount was several thousand, I believe 6,000, I would have to look, or 6,000 or more. But it was a small
amount. So your argument is if she could pay it off, she'd pay it off, and the difference between listing an amount of $4,500 and listing an amount of $6,000 wasn't going to make the difference?
Well, I think the argument is twofold. Number one, the attorney's fees were accurate.
Well, that's contested, right? So I'm not sure we can assume that.
Well, it was contested at the state court level. She raised it in a motion to try to cancel the sale in her briefing. That was rejected. She raised it in a motion to try to stop, to try to...
So later that happened, but at the time it was listed, I think their argument is, under Arizona law, I believe, you're not allowed to just say what you think the fees are. There has to be some other assessment that, and you hadn't done that, and so at least for procedural purposes, it was false at that time.
Well, Your Honor, I think that's their argument, but I think it's incorrect. I think they're taking issue with the way the attorney's fees were obtained. The attorney's fees themselves, there's no evidence in the record that any attorney's fees in there were not incurred, were not owed pursuant to the stipulation. Now, under Arizona law, the Bennett Bloom case has dealt with this very issue and held that in the homeowner's assessment context, when the contract authorizes fees in connection with collecting assessments, that includes post-judgment fees. And district courts in Arizona have repeatedly agreed with that. So, essentially, here is the question is, would including those modest amount of fees in the writ that was submitted and issued by the state court, would that have materially misled the least sophisticated debtor? And the least sophisticated debtor's options were clear. She either doesn't respond and allows the writ to be executed. She contests the fees and files a motion, or she pays them. She chose the second option. She retained two sets of attorneys who filed individual challenges to the writ itself. And the only reasonable interpretation of the court's orders rejecting her challenges, which expressly brought up the attorney's fees issue, is that the state court found nothing wrong with this process. So,
the state court at that point, though, was evaluating the fees as of that, making an evaluation of fees, it doesn't necessarily mean that retroactively it was appropriate to guess at them. I mean, you may have guessed correctly, but like, if he's saying you can't guess at them, they have to be assessed by a court. And do you have a response to that? Are you saying, I think you did name a case, you think there's a case that says you can guess at them?
Well, I think you can. There wasn't, first of all, I wouldn't describe it as a guess. There was, the association had incurred attorney's fees based on the firm's record, and they were included in the writ. And there's several cases, the Fields case out of the Seventh Circuit, the Singer case out of the Seventh Circuit. Those cases involved letters, but it said simply identifying in a communication to a debtor what the attorney's fees are that are claimed to be owed is not a violation. In fact, arguably, it's a violation not to say that because you're not being truthful. So, in this situation, it was a writ filed with the court that was challenged twice. And so, I think here, it's even a more compelling situation that the simple inclusion of attorney's fees that were accrued at that time, that the least sophisticated debtor would have known was coming because she signed a stipulation authorizing the accruing fees. That would not materially mislead her, and it didn't in this situation.
So, the accruing fees part of this stipulation doesn't give her any way of knowing how much that is, right?
At that point, no, Your Honor.
And so the only time that she ever knows how much that is a bare bones statement in the
first learned of the matter, yes.
And then you say that there was then a judicial assessment of the reasonableness of those fees as required under Arizona law?
What there was, Your Honor, there was a challenge to the fees, two challenges.
My question is, was there a judicial assessment of the reasonableness of those fees with a process with which courts are very familiar?
I think, Your Honor, did a court in the state court come out and say in response to an application for fees that, yes, we approve of these? No, that didn't happen. What did happen was there was challenges brought to the state court that included challenges to the fees. I think the only reasonable reading of those orders are that they were rejected. If they had been a problem, if the fees had been a problem, the state court could have stopped the sale.
And the state court was, in considering whether it would reject the efforts to stop the sale, provided with something equivalent to time and task records of the attorney so that it could inferentially be approving the reasonableness?
Well, the appellant brought arguments through counsel arguing that the inclusion of the post-judgment fees were simply unlawful and improper, and the court rejected that argument. So, Your Honors, if I could just turn to the last timely claim here is based on the alleged failure to respond promptly to the appellant's request for a balance statement. And I would just note that there is no court, to appellee's knowledge, has ever held that there is a duty under the FDCPA to respond. In fact, there's nothing, if you read top to bottom the FDCPA, there is nothing in there requiring a debt collector or anyone to respond to any inquiry whatsoever. And I would even note in this court's decision in Guerrero v. RGM Acquisitions, the court noted that the failure to respond to a debtor's request for verification in and of itself is not a violation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Regarding the association's right to recover the deficiency, paragraph 3 of the stipulated judgment, which was the instrument that led to the writ, specifically reserved that right to either directly just pursue monetary judgment and just not foreclose, or in the event that the foreclosure doesn't give them enough money, they get to collect the balance that was reserved.
Were those legal arguments tied together, though? I think you have a timeliness problem with the first one. So is the writ, does the writ incorporate the earlier one?
The basis for the issuance of the writ is this stipulated judgment. It is the foreclosure judgment that authorizes the issuance of the writ. So the writ doesn't exist if not for the stipulated judgment. So these are linked together. And when they go to get the writ issued, they're reviving this stipulated judgment, which reserves that deficiency. Regarding the communications or lack thereof in the months leading up to foreclosure, Ms. McNair in May of 2013 made the 10th $250 payment over a total of $5,000. That was under a second payment plan. She had previously paid about $1,300 under another payment plan. But with that main payment, she included a letter. And as she said, "I believe this is everything I owe. If there is more, let me know." This is to the debt collector that she had been in communications with for 4 years. And I can test that anybody, a sophisticated consumer or not, if you've been in payback mode with somebody for 4 years and you say, "Do I owe anything else?" and that person doesn't respond to you for 3 months, it's not unreasonable to say, "I guess I'm done."
How is it possible that someone could have calculated the payments and thought that they were enough payments under this contract, though? I mean, I don't have the number of my fingertips, but she did not pay the amount that she needed to pay in total, so how could she have calculated? I mean, you'd have to assume she can't calculate that, right?
And I don't think you can. I've calculated a number of times, but I've gotten 10 or 12 or even 11 payments of 250. And the reason is it does not say you need to pay 12 payments of 250. It says you need to pay within a one-year period, you need to pay
2,500. But don't you have to get to 5,500, and then she hadn't?
No, it doesn't say that she has to pay 5,500. CMS, before the stipulation was entered, she offered to pay 5,500. But they didn't just say, "Yes, we'll take your offer." They gave her the stipulation and said, "We'll do this." So her offer is whole evidence. It's separate. I don't think the court should consider what she may have offered as an explanation for what the stipulation means. Because she didn't offer foreclosure and a reduction of her redemption period and liens upon her personal property. All of these are considered in the stipulation. That's a whole separate counteroffer. She accepted it. She signed it. But I don't think the court should. I think the court needs to stay within the four corners of that stipulation. And when you do that, it calls for this $2,500 payment and then additional $250 payments until paid. So, again.
So, are you, sorry, so SCR, can you show me what page of the record you're talking about? And maybe I'm looking at the wrong thing, but is SCR 1 the payment plan? Because it does say
$5,500. Yes, the stipulation.
Where's the document that you think has the payment plan without the $5,500 number in the record?
Paragraph 7 of the stipulation.
And what page of the record is the stipulation?
ER 157 is the specific page of the stipulation that has paragraph 7. So it requires an initial payment of $2,500 on or before July 5th, 2012, and continuing in a minimum amount of $250 per month to be received no later than the 15th of each month until the judgment is paid in full. But there's no total judgment amounts here. And that's what she did. She made those payments. And it's arguable that possibly there was one more payment owed. I think it's hard to argue that there were two, but it's unclear. Because it does not specifically say she needs to pay $5,500 or she needs to pay $1,250 payments. So her question, do I owe any more, is not unreasonable. And it's not unreasonable for her to say, they didn't respond to me. They must not be claiming any more money.
But so it says she has to do $250 per month for 12 months and she'd only done 10 months, right?
She did 10 payments, but when does the 12 months start?
Well, you can't get to 12, even if you count the 2,500, which I don't think is a very reasonable reading. You can't get to 12, can you, in any other way than she owes at least one more payment?
Well, if the first payment was due July 5th, and no later than the 15th of each month thereafter, then, I mean, if the first 250 payment would have been due in August. You could August, September, October, November, December, January, February, March, April, and May. That's 10. So, I mean, that's... I think a very plausible reading of this, and I mean, this thing is confusing. It's hard for anybody, no less the associates, for instance, to know what their obligations are, and she just ignored it. She asked, do I owe any more? And her question was ignored, and it's not a reasonable saying, I must be done.
Okay, thank you. Please, our audio says something that will take us to recess for the court of our schedule.